Channel Coast, all the way from Bournemouth to Brighton. Temperatures in some spots a little bit further inland could even reach 33 degrees. And that's been a while. Remember, a high UV index, so you will burn very quickly in the sunshine. Remember the sunscreen and drink plenty of fluids. But some showers and thunderstorms could well develop in the heat as well. Such will be the heat. So don't be surprised if you're caught in a summertime downpour after it heats up so dramatically. That's it. Charles.
I might have to take my jacket off. Thomas, thanks very much indeed. Thomas Schaffernacker with the forecast there. Well, now, book of the week. Penny Downey reads the final part of A Long Walk Home, Judith Tebbutt's account of her kidnap by Somali pirates in 2011. After nearly 7 months in captivity, and with the knowledge that her husband was killed trying to protect her, Judith prepares for freedom and reunion with her son.
My bed rattled beneath me. I woke straight away. God, it's going to happen, I thought. The usual hushed flurry of activity went on about me, Ali and Karlim taking charge of clearing the room. I checked my watch. It was 11 p.m. Ali smiled broadly. We go now. Three cars were parked in close formation, and I was directed into the middle vehicle. We travelled in convoy. Once we passed into desert, we quickly picked up speed. It was around 7 a.m. when we pulled into a sparsely wooded area, and there we waited. In the silence, Ali nudged me. They wait for the men from the town to come and get you. Then came a new arrival. A cream-beige car pulled into view, announced by a cloud of dust. A well-dressed man got out, sporting reflective aviator sunglasses, attended by a mini-entourage of two more smartly dressed men. This no longer felt like an exchange to me. What was perturbing was the demeanour of my pirates. They appeared newly nervous and edgy and bristling with guns. I saw Kalim, ribbons of bullets crisscrossing his body, run off with a big machine gun and assume a position in the distance. Other pirates dotted themselves about, guns at the ready, visibly in anticipation of something big being about to happen. So, what happens now? You stay here, we wait. Men come, then you get in other car, we go. Beyond my window, there was a palpable tension. Newcomers on new turf had taken charge, seemed to be calling the shots. Again, I feared I was about to be bartered, passed on. A new, higher price put on my life. Then, in an instant, something had changed. Suddenly everyone was shaking hands and hugging, tramping off towards their respective vehicles. The negotiator came over to the car I was in and indicated that I should wind down the window. I chose not to, leaving him to make himself understood through the glass. 10:30, he shouted. What does that mean? Airport, 10:30. So, I am going today? You released today, he said coolly. You released! I allowed myself to be guided into the back of a four-wheel drive. The car in which I'd been driven here was wheeling around and away. Ali rolled down his window and waved at me. I found myself raising a hand in response, since it was the familiar, strangely enough, that I was leaving behind. We crossed flat, barren desert, and then, abruptly, we hit a tarmac road, pockmarked by huge potholes, but indisputably tarmac. My God, civilization. I could see to my left a windsock, a small white light aircraft, a dusty landing strip. We parked, I got out, and then I just stood there feeling the breeze, conscious of a small throng of people to my right snapping photos. I tried to shield my face. The door of the plane opened. Out came a big guy in a bush hat, Crocodile Dundee, I thought. Almost by instinct, my feet started moving me towards him. He took my arm firmly. I'm Jack, come on, we're going home. And then I was inside the plane. The door was wrenched shut. Jack called out, "Go, go, go!" The plane shuddered down the strip at speed and lifted off into the air. I was free. In Nairobi, I was met by two smart, smiling people, a woman introducing herself as Kelly from the UK High Commission and Matt, the Foreign Office's man in Nairobi. I was shown into a big blacked-out saloon car and I got in the back with Kelly, Matt, opposite me. We chit-chatted for the short duration of the drive. It was all a shade unreal. I was drawn just to stare out of the window, watching people going about their daily business, walking the streets, women with baskets on their heads. I couldn't be sure it wasn't another dream. I turned to Kelly. "Are you real?" She smiled warmly. "Yes, I'm real. All of this is real." The car turned and drove up a wide street of rather grand residences. I was brought inside a palatial house, all light and fragrance, beautiful fresh flowers arranged on polished walnut tables, staff in stiff starched white jackets. The British ambassador, Jim Collins, introduced himself. "I've got someone waiting for you upstairs." The staircase seemed to stretch out forever. I had to take one step at a time because I was so weak. I made it to the top, to the doorway into a bedroom. I stepped inside. My son was standing, arms folded, leaning against a wardrobe. Tears welled in my eyes. He opened his arms and we embraced for a long time. Ollie led me into an adjacent sitting room, pulled two chairs together, and then we sat, and he held my hand. For a while, neither of us spoke. Finally, I knew what I wanted to tell him. "You did it. I don't know how you managed, but I knew you would. Always. I'm so proud of you." "No," he said softly. "You did it." "Well then, we both did it. You did your bit, and I did mine." Ollie's composure gave way, and his tears flowed. His emotion had the effect of drying my own eyes. "I haven't cried till now," he said. "I didn't cry for Dad, didn't cry for you. Just because getting you out of there was my only focus." I went into the bathroom, and for some time I simply stood there, in the quiet and the light, as if I were a trespasser in some extraordinary realm of luxury. I stroked a thick white towel on a rail. My hair uncovered was wild, a mess. I undressed, stepped into the shower stall, turned the knob, and immediately it was as if needles were being dropped from a height onto my bare skin. I got out and reached for a towel to dry myself, only to find it so heavy that, absurdly, I couldn't hold it long enough to dry myself properly. The bathroom had a full-length mirror, and in the glass, I saw a person I didn't recognize. I had to look really hard, because everything in my head was saying, "Who is that?" She looked emaciated. There was no flesh on her arms. You could count her ribs. Her hip bones protruded. Her kneecap seemed huge. I thought, if that's me, then if I move my arm, the reflection will move the same way. I did so, and this woman moved her arm in concert. Even as I recovered from the failure to recognize myself, I had to tell myself, in all honesty, I wasn't sure who the woman in the mirror was. Who she used to be, yes, I was highly familiar with that. But not this apparition before me. Physically, I had shrunk. Later, I would discover that I weighed a mere 5 stone. But mentally, too, I felt I had used up a lot of capacity in captivity, never switched off, never sleeping properly. The air of unreality persisted through dinner that evening. The ambassador's table was huge, beautifully laid. The menu was presented on a crest-embossed card. There was an air of formality, and small talk almost inevitably strained to be about everything except what had happened to bring us all here. My hosts couldn't have been kinder, but for 6 months I had been under the pirates' orders. Now I was free and in luxury, but it was a diplomatic version of a decompression chamber, where I was still allotted times to see my son, to sit for dinner, and my presence was required. I decided to have an early night. It was my first night restored to freedom, and I was sure I would sleep soundly. In fact, I didn't sleep at all. Even as I undressed, I had the strangest sensation that the bed was some uncanny replica of the one on which David and I had lain down to sleep in Kiwayu, huge, with white linen shrouded by mosquito nets. A sash window had been left slightly ajar for fresh air. The mosquito net rippled in the breeze, and I began to be plagued by the recurrent feeling that someone else was in the room. I tried to make myself drop off, but I stirred repeatedly, looking about me, thinking frantically, "Is someone there?" By the time the sun rose, I saw no use in lying around in bed. I walked down the concrete steps onto the grass, damp with dew. I touched the hibiscus, watched a hummingbird, sat down on a low-cut tree stump, pulled my knees up to my chin and hugged them. "You're out," I told myself. Then crazily a thought bubbled up. I wonder what the pirates are doing now. What's Amina up to, not having to cook for anyone? Weeks passed, but eventually I had to return to our house in Bishop's Stortford. The house was strangely quiet and cold. The thought did cross my mind. That was a bloody long holiday. The cats came to greet me, and straight away I went into the routine of feeding them, a funny kind of back to normal. Then I went into each of the rooms one by one, as if looking for somebody. I reached the spare room. Sitting on the bed were the Holdalls we'd taken away on holiday with us. They had been flown back to the UK together with David's body. I could see his walking shoes poking out of his. Tears welled up and out of me, and I didn't fight them back. I knelt on the floor, and I hugged my husband's belongings, the vestiges of him. I had a burning urge to carry these bags back to Syrian camp, so that we'd be there as we were then, and we wouldn't go to Kiwayu Island. We'd change the fates, go somewhere, anywhere else instead. That night I switched on the radio and the television, and I watched through a blur of tears. I had been weeping for hours. My eyes were stinging, my nose was sore. And in my head, I felt I could change the gears. "You've done enough of this for one night. This is when you stop." And I did. Every morning I awoke in Somalia, I had a clear goal: to make it to the end of another day. With the gift of freedom, I needed new goals. Now I see the days stretching out ahead of me, a daunting expanse. What am I to do with it? What am I going to do without David? Where do I go from here? I'm not grounded. My anchor is gone. I wonder how long I will be at sea.
Benny Downey was reading the final instalment from A Long Walk Home by Judith Tabbett. The abridger was Miranda Davis and the producer Justine Willett. And now the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 13th of July. The general synopsis at 1800, high Thames 1025, dissipating by 1800 Saturday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cira, variable 3 or 4, becoming westerly or northwesterly 4 or 5. Rain at times, fog patches at first, moderate to very poor, becoming good. South at Cira, northwesterly 4 or 5, increasing 6 or 7 in east. Fog patches then fair, moderate to very poor, becoming good. Forties, Cromarty 4th, variable 3 or 4, becoming north 4 or 5 for a time. Fog patches or banks, then mainly fair, moderate to very poor, becoming good. Tyne, Dogger, variable 3, becoming north or northeast 4 or 5.